Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and here I am recording the show on Friday, October 15th, 2021. This week's show begins on kind of a sad note. We lost two huge talents this week, didn't we?
Yes, we did. It was not a great week for legendary people in the animation sphere, but they had very long and productive lives, so I'm heartened by that.
That is true. So should we go ladies first, or do we want to talk about Mr. DePatie first?
Well, why don't you talk about Mr. DePatie, because I don't know if as many people know about him.
All right. Well, David H. DePatie started his career at Warner Brothers Animation back in the early 1960s, ironically, just as they're getting out of the theatrical short business. We know him today largely because he teamed up with Friz Freleng. He was one of the very first animators to work with Walt. He actually worked in the Alice comedies as well as the Oswald shorts. Friz eventually decamped from Disney and wound up at Termite Terrace, where he helped the talented animators at Warner's launch the Looney Tunes series. Warner Brothers closes its animation studios in 64, but Dave and Friz team up to form DePatie Freleng Enterprises. They are working out of the exact same building, Termite Terrace, that all of the great Warner Brothers shorts were produced in. But the character that puts him on the map is the Pink Panther, created for the title sequence of Blake Edwards' March of 54 comedy. The character gets spun off immediately into its own series of shorts. And the very first short in the series, The Pink Fink, gets released in December 64 and takes home that year's Oscar for Best Animated Short.
Before Richard Williams took over, didn't he do the intros?
Yeah, he did Return of the Pink Panther and Pink Panther Strikes Again. But again, DeFrilling did Saturday morning cartoons, likewise animated specials like 1970s ones, The Cat in the Hat. We also know them from the title sequence of the original I Dream of Jeannie. But here's the thing I didn't know until just this week. DePatie Freleng did the lightsabers effect for the very first Star Wars movie.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I'd never seen that up until now. Anyway, DePatie Freleng gets bought by Marvel Studios in 1980, which then renames this animation studio Marvel Animation. So, Drew, that makes DePatie Freleng Disney property now, right?
I guess so. It's hard to figure out who owns what these days, especially in historical context.
Okay, so that's Mr. DePatie, but we also lost a genuine Disney legend this week.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Ruthie? Or?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm sure everybody saw Bob Iger tweeted out about her, which I thought was really crazy. She died at the age of 111, which is how I think you and I will be that age when we finish this show, Jim. So she was born in Portland, Maine back in July of 1910 and was recruited by Walt Disney himself to come be an inker at the animation studio. Ruthie spent almost 40 years working at Disney, quickly rising through the ranks to become an animation checker and later a camera technician. And she eventually became the supervisor of feature animation scene planning department. And yeah, she's worked on every Disney feature film, from Snow White to The Rescuers when she retired in 1975. That's amazing. And she was lauded for being a female pioneer in the film industry and was officially named a Disney legend back in 2000. Pretty amazing, don't you think?
What I love about Ruthie, though, is that she kept current. In fact, she eventually ends up at the motion picture and television fund Country Home. But in her 90s, she's working on their in-house television channel. She's the one doing tech work. She's the one working with Final Cut Pro, putting together short films and ads for the people in the community. When she passes away earlier this week, she's 111. She's the oldest member of Women in Animation. And Ruthie is one of a handful of people on the planet who experienced two pandemics. She survived the Spanish flu in 1919 and the COVID outbreak of 2020. And Drew and I offer our sincerest condolences to the friends and family of David H. DePatie and Ruthie Thompson at this sad, sad time. Turning to a happier topic, earlier this week, you got to talk with friend of the show, Josh Gad, and you got to talk about his next project for Disney Plus. Olaf Presents. Can you tell us a little bit about this new series of animated shorts?
Yeah, I mean, the whole concept of this new series of shorts is based on when Olaf was recounting the events of the first Frozen in Frozen 2. So this time we have him telling the stories of Tangled, Moana, The Little Mermaid, Aladdin, and The Lion King. So I'm pretty excited. And, they were directed by Hyram Osmond, nephew mm-hmm. of Donnie and Marie, who did the At Home with Olaf micro shorts. I think he animated those all himself.
Crazy.
Crazy. So these will be debuting on Disney Plus November 12th, which is, of course, Jim, I know you've got it circled in your calendar, Disney Plus Day.
Oh, God, that's right. Yes. So I have to admit, I love the promotional line for Olaf Presents. It's like his interpretation of the classics is classic. And now, again, you actually got to talk with Josh about this next set of shorts. Olaf Presents touches on three of the hand-drawn films from Disney's second Golden Age. So we got Mermaid from 89, Aladdin from 1992, and Lion King from 94, and then two CG films from Disney Animation's, what might argue is the third flowering, 2010's Tangled and 2016's Moana, but nothing from Disney's first Golden Age. What did Josh have to say about that?
I believe he said he wanted to do like Cinderella and Pinocchio, but they said, no, Josh, you sit there and you make funny noises. but he said, there's a possibility that he could be back for further short films. So I think we just have to cross our fingers and hope that not only are these shorts widely embraced, but that Josh and Hyram and the rest of the creative team get another crack, because I know you and I would love to hear Olaf try to explain Saludos Amigos, Jim. That would be very funny to me. So we will have to wait for that, though.
Okay. I can get behind that. If there's a second season of Olaf Presents, we'll share that news as soon as we hear it. And speaking of news, the news portion of today's fine-tuning is brought to you by Storybook Destinations, trusted travel partner of the Jim Hill Media Podcast Network. For a worry-free travel experience, please book online at storybookdestinations.com. By the way, no disrespect intended by saying if there'll be another season of Olaf Presents. But, to be honest, it's always kind of a crapshoot when it comes to these streaming services. I mean, I'm still waiting to see if we get a season two of The Magic of Disney's Animal Kingdom, which was narrated by Josh. Likewise, A Dog's Life with Bill Farmer. I really enjoyed both of these series. I would love to see them get a season two. Speaking of Bill Farmer, are you familiar with Streamly, Drew?
No. What is Streamly?
I don't know, okay? But earlier this week, Nancy is sitting there with her phone watching Streamly. And who's on Streamly but our buddy Bill Farmer, the voice of Goofy, likewise the voice of Hop Pop on Disney's Amphibia. While Bill's on there, and he seems to be autographing photos for fans of Goofy, but while he's on there, he's talking about how there's supposedly a documentary in the works about the Goofy movie. Evidently, Kevin Lima, the director of that film, has tons of behind-the-scenes footage when it comes to the making of this 1995 Walt Disney Pictures Disney Movie Toons release. And you did a story of size about that for
yes. Vulture, didn't you? Vanity Fair, but yes.
Vanity Fair, yeah.
I encourage everybody to look that up. We did. I talked to Kevin Lima, I talked to Bill, and I talked to Don, obviously. Mm-hmm. And that's a really interesting look at just how sort of under the radar a Goofy movie was and how it's become such a cult sensation in the years since.
Bill was actually talking about that, mentioning how it started out as a sort of a plain Jane goof troupe movie, but over 2 years, and did this bear out in your research, 40 different recording sessions?
Oh, wow.
He talked about how over those 2 years, it became the sort of father-son buddy movie that we all know and love today. By the way, he pointed out that the difference between, say, the Goofy movie and the Extremely Goofy movie, that direct-to-video release from February of 2000, first film, 2 years, 40 sessions, second film, only 4 recording sessions, and then boom, out the door it goes. Bill does mention as part of the Extremely session that Kevin's A Goofy Movie documentary is still a year or so away, so gotta wonder if maybe this will turn up on Disney Plus as well.
Maybe he'll make a Monkeys of Mumbai documentary after that.
I would love that. And by the way, Bill also said that his favorite line out of a Goofy movie is, "How many cups of sugar does it take to get to the moon?" Bill is also very, very excited about the third season of Disney's Amphibia, which got underway on the Disney Channel back on October 2nd. Says there's lots of great moments, touching scenes coming up in this season of that animated series. And speaking of animated series, did you see the trailer that dropped today for DreamWorks Animation's latest sort of spinoff of the How to Train Your Dragons film franchise, the Dragons, the Nine Realms?
I got the press release. I didn't get a chance to watch the trailer. I'm glad that there are still dragons adventures out there in the world, but I have not gotten a chance to check this one out yet. What did you think?
I'm kind of just intrigued by the premise. Do you want to read the log line on this thing? Which this one is set in a different time, isn't it?
Yes, it is actually set 1,300 years after the time of Hiccup and Toothless. And it starts off in the modern world, where dragons are now just a legend. When a geological anomaly opens up an immense miles-deep fissure in the Earth's surface, scientists from all over the world gather at a new research facility to study the mysterious phenomenon. Soon a group of misfit kids, brought to the site by their parents, uncover the truth about dragons and where they've been hiding, a secret they must keep to themselves to protect what they've discovered. That is much crazier than I was expecting, Jim. I gotta say that.
Same thing here. And again, we've talked about Adventure Time on the show previously, and, you know, because of your association with Pendleton Ward. But what's kind of interesting about Dragons and Nine Realms is fans of Adventure Time will probably want to check out this show when it premieres on Hulu and Peacock. In fact, we have a date on that, December 23rd. Is that right?
Yes, Jim. You'll be in your footy pajamas, I think, around then, and just curled up watching Dragons and Nine Realms.
You laugh. I came within inches. I just, you ever seen, they have that A Christmas Story, the horrifying pink bunny outfit?
Yes.
They make that in adult sizes now, and I recently came across one and came very close to becoming a Pepto-Bismol nightmare. Anyway, back to Adventure Time. Jeremy Shatta, I believe I'm saying the name right, he voiced Finn on Pendleton Ward's animated series, but he's voicing one of the leads on this How to Train Your Dragon spinoff. Speaking of television, did you catch the show on ABC earlier this week, the special they did about a night at the Academy of Motion Picture Museum?
No, I actually want to go to the museum for myself at some time point, and I feel like I'm just living through people's Instagrams and won't have anything to actually marvel at when I get to the museum. But please let us go through and ruin several other things that are at the museum, Jim.
There is clearly a lot to see. Today, we're just going to touch on what they showed for the animation galleries. And Everybody in town wants to be represented. So, for example, there's this gallery where they have maquettes, and they showed Shrek and Fiona and Anna, Elsa, and Olaf from Frozen.
Did you notice the Shrek was the Chris Farley version of Shrek?
I was wondering about that. In fact, the Fiona's fairly early as well.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, and they have a Bugs Bunny maquette from the 40s. In fact, I'm fairly certain this is the Bob Clampett era of Bugs. Oh. A bunch of Jack Skellington heads, and Toy Story was represented, but it was represented by a maquette for Looter Larry and Woody as ventriloquist dummy.
Oh, good. So if you need a one-stop shop for nightmares, go to the animation section.
I think you and I talked previously about how we missed the zoetrope from California Adventure's Magic of Disney Animation. That just disappeared one day.
Yeah.
And, well, now here it is. It's on display at the Museum of the Motion Picture.
I think the first time I saw it, do you remember when it was at the MoMA in New York as part of the Pixar exhibit there?
That's right.
I still have my little catalog from that exhibit. That was great.
That was a great exhibit. I just wanted to bring up that here they have Danny Glover narrating the animation portion of the show. And so the camera now shows Danny standing in front of Frank Thomas's desk. And Danny makes a point of going, well, this is on loan from Pete Docter. Pete Docter himself have helped select the images that we use to talk about the history of Toy Story. And it's that John Lasseter thing all over again. Remember how you'd go to a Disney event and you'd watch somebody on stage sort of turn themselves into a pretzel to work in a reference to John Lasseter?
Yeah. Well, did you see that Pete was at the Walt Disney World 50th anniversary?
Was he really?
For some reason. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It just gets kind of obnoxious after a while when you're the new boss and the people who work below you want to credit the new boss, and so that they will shoehorn a reference into, wow, this cheese sandwich is amazing. And you know who likes cheese? Pete Docter.
Pete Docter picked out this cheese himself.
There we go. Though I do want to point out that the animation exhibit at the Museum of the Motion Picture does make an effort to show that animation didn't, in fact, start at Disney. In fact, they make a point of playing up Winsor McCay and Gertie the Dinosaur film. Likewise, Lottie Renegar, who worked mostly in silhouette animation, I think that hers is the first ever feature-length animated film, The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which got released in 1926, whereas Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which a lot of people think of as the first full-length animated film, that was until 37. Somewhat more controversial, though, is they spent a lot of time in the animation exhibit sort of leaning into exploring the less savory aspects of animation history. For example, Pepe Le Pew and all of the various animated men who chase after Betty Boop are cited for sexual violence or unwanted affection played for comedy. There's also a lot of talk about racist caricatures are used in cartoons of the 20s, 30s, 40s, and the like. But we are putting this stuff in the front window with the hope that we will learn from the past and leave that kind of history behind us. So when do you see yourself getting over there?
Well, before the Miyazaki exhibit leaves, obviously. Yeah.
There we go. The museum officially opened on September 30th. The Miyazaki exhibit, which is the first of its kind in North America, that runs through June 5th, 2022. They've tried to make it both kid and adult friendly. There's a thing that Miyazaki likes to do in his film. They create these deliberately quiet moments. You as the audience are supposed to be able to feel the emotions that the characters on screen are having, but you do that through these quiet moments. They've created this spot in the museum where you supposedly can do that. It's a faux grassy hillside that you're encouraged to lie down on and then look up, because Studio Ghibli has created this faux blue sky filled with clouds, and you're just supposed to sit there and have your own, I think the Japanese word for it is ma, quiet of moment reflection. And
that's pretty funny coming from an animation studio that literally worked people to death. I think that is hilarious. But I appreciate the sentiment. I love Studio Ghibli movies, of course, but that makes me laugh, Jim.
Okay. Well, speaking of the Studio Ghibli films, all 11 of them are currently streaming over here at HBO Max. Netflix, though, has a lot of great animation coming up. And in fact, on the second half of today's show, we're going to talk in depth about some of the streaming service's upcoming animated projects.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
And we're back. And Drew, you spent a good chunk of this past weekend paying attention to what went on at DC Fandom, right?
Oh, yeah, I did. It was sort of a non-event, but I thought that Batman trailer was very cool. And we got some new information about the new Bruce Timm animated series called Batman Caped Crusader, which he described as being more Batman the Animated Series than Batman the Animated Series, which I think is something that you and I are very excited about, given our love of that seminal 1990s animated series.
I'm intrigued by the more Batman than Batman the Animated Series. That's a ridiculously high bar.
Yeah, he says they're going more authentically 40s kind of in hats and blimps mm-hmm. and all this stuff, and but that the casting is going to be more inclusive and more 2021, mm-hmm. which I think is just the perfect way to do mm-hmm. it. So I just cannot wait to see what they cook up between him, J.J. Abrams, and Matt Reeves, hopefully coming in the next year or so.
This is a virtual event that started back in June of 2020. It was kind of Warner Brothers and DC's answer to the fact that Comic-Con, the pop culture thing that's held in San Diego because of the pandemic, was canceled last year. And so they did this one, even though we are still getting Comic-Con special edition.
That's right. And I think there was a Comic-Con virtual edition earlier this year too.
Comic-Con at home. But it's kind of interesting to me the fact that tickets to Comic-Con special edition went on sale September 25th. Comic-Con tickets, typically when they go on sale, they sell out like in an hour, right? I mean, or at least the 4-day badges, that sort of thing. And it kind of says a lot to me about this particular version of the event that we are 3 weeks after they've gone on sale and they're still available.
Yeah. Well, I think it's going to be an uphill battle because you're talking about the first Thanksgiving. Some people will be able to spend with their loved ones in 2 years. You're asking them to kind of put that aside to go see people dressed up as Star Trek characters walking around a convention center. It's not the biggest draw, I think. But it's very depressing because, so many of those businesses and restaurants and bars and hotels depend on that that draw. So I don't know. Yeah, I will not be there, but I understand the need and desire to want to go and participate. Mm. But yeah, it's weird that it hasn't sold out yet.
Just this past weekend, there was New York Comic Con. One of the big reveals at that event was they showed the first two episodes of Star Trek Prodigy.
Yeah, we got to get people from Prodigy on the show.
I agree. And speaking of getting people on, I'm sorry. While Drew spent Saturday paying attention to how long were you on a fandom?
It was 10 to 2, Jim. It was a lovely way to spend my Saturday on Skype or on Slack. Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay, so he spends 4 hours watching fandom. I, on the other hand, spent 4.5 hours on Sunday watching Maya and the Three, which is this 9-part miniseries that's going to debut on Netflix this coming Friday, October 22nd. Did you see how Maya and the Three has been described? It's Lord of the Rings only hilarious.
Yes.
And it was the first time it's a real bullet point. I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
This was one of my favorite things I've seen all year. It comes to us from Jorge Gutierrez and his lovely wife, Sandra Aguilla. She's actually the creative consultant and it was a designer on the show as well. I could not wait to talk to these two, all right? I prepped questions because, again, it was so good, so enjoyable. And I'm an idiot, all right, who can't tell time because I was sitting here waiting for it to be the time because it's on LA time. So I'm sitting here waiting for it to be 5:50 so I can hop on Zoom to be with Drew and so I can interview Jorge and Sandra. And not 10 minutes ago, I get a phone call from Drew, who basically says, you missed our interview. And it's like, what do you mean I missed your interview? It's not starting for another 20 minutes. It's like, it's LA time. Okay, do the math with me, Jim. You add 3 hours to 1:40? Is that 5:40? Yes. Or is that 4:40? And it's like, ow! Yeah. So what you're about to listen to, and by the way, thanks so much to the very nice folks at Netflix for setting this up. But this is Drew. He's vamping because he's waiting for me to show up.
Yes, I did. I let the record state, Your Honor, that I did send a text at 1:52, 2 minutes after the interview started, saying, are you signing on? So had Jim. I'm gonna have to buy you an Apple Watch, Jim, so these will pop up, you know, it'll vibrate on your wrist. But
see, this is the thing. I do the thing where I put the phone in the other room because I have a sound engineer, a certain Aaron Adams, who keeps telling me to put the phone in other rooms because it will turn up and make noise. And I did that.
Well, let me also state, Jim, not that you are an elderly man or anything, but you do have health problems from time to time. And I was more concerned that you had like fallen in a ditch or something. So when I called you, I was just relieved to hear your voice. You were okay. You were alive. Mm. That was what is important to me.
I'm alive, but I'm so disappointed because, again, let's let Drew talk with Hori and Sandra and let them explain why this, honestly, folks, this is appointment viewing. This is something, I mean, I realize 4.5 hours is a huge chunk of time, but you really need to set aside the time to see Mai and the Three. But let's listen to Drew and Hori and Sandra explain how this ridiculously ambitious animated series came to be.
Good to see you finally. I feel like we're interacting on Twitter all the time, so it's nice.
Face to face.
Face to face.
Drew wrote very kind words about Maya.
Aww. That's really nice.
I loved it. Yes, it is quite an accomplishment. You should both be very proud. And I am sure that it is a relief that it is finally over, right?
Well, I mean, we keep joking.
It's not. I think it's just started.
It's like, oh, no.
We've been pregnant for 3 years, and this baby's got to get out.
Yeah, it's like you're like, oh, how lovely it would be to have a child. And then when it's finally out, you're like, oh, my gosh. Here comes the rest of it. Yeah.
Well, what else do you have to do? I mean, are there toys coming?
There's a lot of interviews happening.
Just how people react to it, you know, like.
And then the award season is, I mean, we've started award season, so it doesn't feel like we're going to be done promoting for a while.
Right. One thing that I loved that you guys did that I wanted to ask you about that people don't do a lot, and it always makes me question why they don't, is you went out of the frame. You went into the black, and I was wondering where that came from. What was the inspiration, and how did you decide when to do it and when not to do it?
So I wanted to do it a ton on Book of Life, and 20th Century Fox Studios, which no longer exist, wouldn't let me. So this was my revenge to be able to go in there. And then I remember when 3D movies were a big deal. And studios were trying to figure out how to sell that to people at home. Mm-hmm. They literally had stuff go into the black. Mm-hmm. And I found it super weird and funny. And so for Maya, I said, well, what if we treated that seriously? And what if we used that as another element to tell the story? And obviously, like, I'd seen, Samurai Jack or Scott Pilgrim versus the World sort of play around with that stuff. So for us, it was, well, let's literally put it in the scripts and let's use it as another form of, just like music and color and sound, let's use it as another tool to help tell the story. Mm-hmm. So when a big deal happens, we have characters break it. And then in the fights, whoever's in control, the frame gets bigger for them. And at the end, Maya does her final thing. Literally, the frame opens for her. She's bigger than the film.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And it kind of pulls you in a really fun way.
Oh, glad.
And it's a surprise. Yeah, I mean, and it's surprising Fox didn't let you do it because I feel like Book of Life is the biggest example of that too. Not Book of Life, sorry, Life of Pi, where the
Life of Pi did it.
Yeah, the fish are coming out, and I think he does like 6 different aspect ratios or something like.
And by the way, I argued that, and they said Book of Life is for little kids, and they're gonna get confused. That's the argument they gave me.
Well, can you talk about what it was like working with Netflix? I mean, you're obviously both part of this amazing kind of stable of creators there that are doing things in animation. What was that like?
It's been remarkable. And honestly, at least in my 21 years of career, I've never been trusted like this.
Yeah.
And it's a double-edged sword, which I love, which is, hey, if you do something terrible, it's your fault. We trust you. And if you do something awesome, hey, you did it. So I will take that over the other one, which is we control everything. And if it's great, it's because of us. And if it's a mess, it's kind of because of you. Like, that's basically the other world where I came from. So this has been very, very different.
I'd also like to add that it's like, I've said it before, but it's like a golden ticket that we got where Jorge was like asked to go ahead and pitch some something, whatever came out of his head. I think that that's not very common because it could scare a lot of people, you know, like if you just blurt out where you have an idea, and blurt out he did, you know, like he came up with this like epic, crazy idea, and he pitched it out to them. And, you know, Netflix was open-minded enough and gracious enough to say, sure.
And by the way, when take a shot. For anybody who's seen it, I pitched the ending. That's basically how I pitch stuff. I go, this is how it is. And the ending to Maya is not a traditional ending, right? There's no season two coming. So most people freak out. They're like, what? What if it's a huge hit? What if we want to make more? It's like, no. This is contained. This is like Seven Samurai. There's no Seven Samurai 2. Like, this is just one.
Right. Maya and the Four is not coming. We should warn people of that. Yes. Yes. And the Four. Well, I've heard other creators, and you know, I've spoken to so many people that are working on animated things at Netflix, that there does seem to be some camaraderie and some back and forth between creators. So I was wondering, did you guys show this to other people working at the studio? Was there any feedback that you remember from any of these screenings? What was that process like?
So early on, I was part of basically one of the early generations. So I got to show the first version of this to Elizabeth Ito from City of Ghosts, to Megan Dong from Centaur World, Kirk McCracken from Kid Cosmic, Chris Williams from the Sea Beast. And it was kind of crazy. It was a crazy time because we were all basically given carte blanche to make our dream projects. Mm-hmm. So you don't want to derail anybody and you want to be incredibly supportive.
Yeah.
So I don't think any of us gave anybody
everybody was scratching everybody's back,
right.
I think most of our interactions were like, I can't believe they're letting us do this. So it was definitely a magical time. And then Henry Selick was who's my basically one of my giant living heroes. So being able to like have lunch with them and show them stuff, that was insane. I don't know if that world will ever happen again because it was a magical time.
Yeah.
But man, I feel so lucky I got to be a part of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, somebody else that's working on a Netflix animated movie is your old buddy Guillermo. And I was wondering if he saw early cuts or offered any suggestions or anything like that. Obviously, he was a huge cheerleader for Book of Life. So I was wondering, did that continue?
Yeah, I mean, we had a catch-up lunch maybe a year ago when I had enough footage. You know, he's my hero. So I was like, Guillermo, I want to be able to show you some stuff. And he's like, okay, show it to me. You know, this is mid-COVID. So it was a remote lunch. And I showed him, like, I don't know, it must have been like 10 minutes worth of footage. And I was like, what do you think? I was super nervous, right? And he goes, Gordo, this is so you. It's perfect. And that was it. I was like, we're on the right path, everybody.
Well, I can say, you know, like knowing him, that was probably true because he's very blunt. He has absolutely no filter.
Especially
with Jorge. Like if he doesn't like it, he'll just blurt it out.
Yeah. He'll go like, Gordo, why you poop in my face with this stuff?
Well, I was wondering, so it's not real. It's a movie, I guess, broken up into nine parts. Is what you say, right? Yeah. Okay, and it has a feature level of animation, and I was wondering how kind of logistically you broke that down. I mean, I'm assuming it is not a $300 million movie, so how you kind of like made that happen? You know what I mean? Because if you made a 9-hour Pixar movie, I mean, I don't think there is enough money in the world to pay for that. So I was wondering how you kind of made that happen.
We made it work like a movie. Honestly, we treated it like a 4.5-hour movie. I was directing every episode. The board artists, instead of doing episodes, they were doing sequences of all 9 at the same time. So we really looked at Lord of the Rings and we said, hey, they made three movies at the same time. I'm a bearded fat guy. If Peter Jackson can do it, I can do it. So...
His logic, I swear.
The math is solid.
I mean, it's airtight as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Story of my life.
Yeah. But there is kind of a sad coda to this, which is that your animation studio shut down afterwards. Yeah. And I was wondering, what was your experience with them? Did you try to kind of intercept on behalf of them with Netflix? So, you know, as much as you can say, what kind of happened there?
Well, I'm heartbroken. Those guys are brilliant. Tangent Animation in Toronto and Winnipeg did remarkable, incredible work. And so after they delivered, and this happened, right? Future projects with Netflix didn't work out. I was devastated. Because these become your friends and your literally your family.
Yeah.
I mean, thankfully, that collective group has, of course, and obviously obvious to everybody, everybody found the job immediately because there's so much work happening over there. But that collective, like, they were the freaking Beatles over there. So that's the most sad thing for me, that collection of people that grew, that's been, you know, they did Next Gen and then they did Maya. They were brilliant together. So I'm heartbroken as everybody else.
Not to mention,
I wanted to make my next movie over there. So.
Not to mention that, like, when you're working with somebody and you have like this wonderful chemistry with them, and you created this nice dance that you have with them, where they say, "I will give you this, and you give me back this." Like, they had such a good fluid rhythm going on, mm-hmm. and then for it to just end, and then not be able to work with that again, it's kind of heartbreaking.
Yeah. I mean, you as a designer and a creator, I imagine do not give them easy tasks. I mean, even with the design of all the characters, I don't think you've ever seen characters in CGI that are that bulky, that have that many kind of layers. It's amazing, but I mean, it must have been hell for these poor guys having to animate this.
I think they're used to it by now.
You come into my cantina, you know what kind of drinks you're gonna get.
Right. Was there any design that was too challenging for them? They said, we cannot have that many skulls dangling off of this character.
Well, I mean, what usually happens, as you know, is the character designers, their stuff gets a little bit watered down by each department. So that they're easier to light, easier to animate, easier to blah, blah, blah. Because I'm a character designer and I'm the director.
Lucky. must be nice.
I don't let anybody water down the character designs. And honestly, yeah, it's why the stuff looks the way it looks. Another weird thing we do is we design the characters, literally. Sandra designs the girls, I design most of the dudes. Mm-hmm. We design them first as I'm writing. So by the time... Mm-hmm. It gets to, like, when I pitch Maya, I had a maquette of Maya done. I'm like, okay, this is what the character looks like. This is what the ending of the show is. If you don't like the way she looks and the way it ends, tell me now and we'll shake hands and we won't work together. So I basically go in with a look already established.
Okay.
And these characters are really, really crazy, but we always talk about, we love sculptures. And so they should work as a sculpture by itself.
A still.
And if they move, then it's a bonus. But the sculpture has to work by itself.
This is why we need toys or something. Please,
yes, for the love of God,
get in touch with Sideshow or something. We need we need Alfred Molina's, you know, face to open up and all that. can I ask what some of the inspiration was? I mean, obviously you mentioned Genndy's Samurai Jack. You can definitely feel that. But I mean, this kind of, the scope of inspiration seems really broad, everything from kind of giant monster movies, not to give anything away, but, you know, to these more personal stories. What were both of you looking at during the production of Mayan 3?
So for me, honestly, I went back to the epics that I love. So I rewatched Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. There's a lot of spaghetti western stuff in Maya. I definitely went back to rewatch Seven Samurai, this idea of armies and people making a difference, even though there's hundreds and hundreds of characters. I also went back to my anime favorite. So I rewatched Ninja Scroll, which make, you know, fighting specific demons. There's a lot of references to that. And then another big one for me was Baron Munchausen. The alien version of these characters that are good at a certain thing. And this leader who's flawed.
Well, you forgot.
And then obviously we went back and we watched Wizard of Oz because Maya is Dorothy. And then the three are basically the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, and the Lion.
Mm-hmm. Right. But a lot more murder than in
Wizard of Oz. Hey, Dorothy shows up and straight up and murders
that poor,
that poor witch was doing nothing bad.
Well, I mean, did you think of this as an epic initially, or was it the kind of carte blanche freedom that Netflix gave you that said, yeah, I can make this 9 parts? I mean, what was that?
You went both ways.
No. I mean, honestly, it was like, this is the, you know, the mother of all animated epics. Yeah. Epics having epic babies. Like, I basically, yeah, I went all in, and it was even bigger, I have to admit. It was
really
what you guys are seeing is
those poor writers.
Yeah, man. Thanks to Sandra, I kind of grounded it a little more, and there were a lot more deaths before.
Yeah,
really.
Okay. Even more.
Well, you know, you start out. I think we can talk about the first episode because
yeah,
that it's the first 30 minutes. But you know, you're killing off all of Maya's brothers. That's pretty hardcore for a show that seemingly little kids can watch. I think everybody can enjoy it. But what were there discussions about how intense to go?
Yeah, and I kept bringing up Bambi, and you know, I kept saying, well, we're not as bloody as Finding Nemo, where they murder 500 babies
and the mom
and the mother. Like, that's nothing compared to that. And then I also said, as a story, if you know, because animation is full of fake deaths. If you have characters die early, then the audience knows the stakes are real.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to admit that the movie was like, I mean, the series was a roller coaster of emotion. And you need to have those deaths in order to have that, right?
I mean, I always reference Pan's Labyrinth. Guillermo, you know, one of the things he did in that movie that's brilliant is one of the first deaths in that movie is a helpless old man. Right, the captain kills him with a bottle, and the rest of the movie, you're like, "Holy cow! Anything that can happen to someone that innocent, what will happen to everybody else?"
Dude, Game of Thrones, right? Like, it's it was true.
Yep.
Who's what? Next?
Yeah. Well, and you do have a beautiful, you know, because you have this element of the spirit world. You know, just because the characters are gone does not mean they're totally gone, and you make that so clear in a way that, like, yeah, they're still sort of around, but nobody's coming back from one of these battles, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
You can zoom with them, but you can't hug them.
No. Well, I mean, have you started thinking about the next baby after completing this journey?
Oh yeah, we're working on a new movie for Netflix Animation, and it's gonna be pretty crazy. And spoiler alert: there's Mexicans in it.
Oh my god. Is this another all ages? I mean, would you like to do a?
Yeah, I take it.
Okay.
And then we're doing a bunch of stuff with different departments, one of which is the adult animation department. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of stuff coming, but we're way, way, way early. And of course, if Maya does really well, I think they're going to trust me. If Maya doesn't do well, then, you know, I might not get to do some of the more crazy ones.
Well, I think they'll trust. I mean, what does an adult animated Jorge project look like? Is it just...
Oh, it's
okay. When he pitched it to me, I felt like...
You felt dirty.
Oh my god, Jorge, that's not right. Like, really not right. Like, there is like really adult like ideas in there, and it's not like him, you know, like... I didn't know that part of his brain existed.
This is
who you're married to.
Yeah.
It's like discovering that you're...
Yeah, this enchilada has a lot more flavors than you thought.
Yeah, like, I thought I knew him, and then he pitched that to me, and I was like, oh.
But then you were like, can I design it?
Yeah, I did.
And now you are.
Yeah. Now I am.
Okay, of course. Well, I mean, I think animation is in a pretty good place this year, especially because it was one of the only things that could keep happening during the pandemic. Have you guys been watching a lot of stuff? Have there been stuff that have been inspiring you as you're going along this journey?
I have to say, Mitchell's versus the Machines really knocked my socks off. I had heard about it for years, and it was even better than I had dreamt it was going to be. And then Demon Hunter, the anime, I'm hooked. I'm so hooked. I'm like, what did happen next?
Isn't it like it's like one of the biggest hits in China or something, right? Yeah, it's
I mean, I saw that it dethroned the Miyazaki movie Spirited Away as the biggest box office hit in Japan. the movie did, and I was like, how dare they bump Miyazaki? I gotta see what this is all about. And then I saw the movie and I was like, this makes no sense to me. I need to watch the series. And then I watched the whole series and now I'm like,
and now you're hooked.
I love this.
Well, you mentioned the awards campaigning that you are about to embark on. What is this going to be submitted as a show, as a movie? Yeah. Do you know, like, okay, what is it? So it's going to be a TV show?
It's going to be submitted as a TV show. So other TV shows, we're coming for you.
Okay. Is there ever any chance of some kind of theatrical exhibition for it? Oh, I mean, Netflix is buying up theaters.
How is that going to work?
You did one night, half of it, and the next night the other half.
I mean, London Film Festival showed 4 episodes in a row and it went really well. And then I just went through the Guadalajara Film Festival and I saw it with a full audience, first 2 episodes.
Weren't you on the balcony?
And I was on the balcony and people were laughing and cheering. And you know, the idea from the beginning was a lot of kids, and especially people like us, we discovered movies on television, right? I saw Good, the Bad, and the Ugly and Seven Samurai on TV. We didn't see them at a revival house cinema because we just didn't have those. So the idea from the beginning was, let's pretend these were movies. And now you get to see them at home.
And what have you interacted with people that have watched some of the episodes? I mean, what has that been like? I mean, if you both gave up 3 years of your life, right?
Yeah, like, they survived. They were actually like, a lot of them had under eye circles. Yeah, a lot of them had puffy eyes.
They pinched it.
And then
obviously, like, some people are angry. They're like, I want more. I'm like, no, right. That's just it. No, you have to make more. And it's like, sorry, the restaurant's closed.
Right.
It was a pop-up.
But you could do something else in this world, perhaps, right?
I just read there's Gladiator 2 coming. So
shut the door. Oh my God.
So anything is possible, Drew.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I saw somebody on Twitter, somebody that I follow has already watched it twice. So, I mean, that's pretty hardcore.
My God.
What aspect of this, I mean, besides the fact that, you know, this is a very Mexican story that I feel like a lot of people will see themselves in that aren't represented a lot. What is your favorite aspect of Maya and the Three, or the thing that you're most excited about people sort of getting out of this?
I'd say just that it's like a cornucopia of a lot of detail and that they're going to be able to go back, like that person you just mentioned, and like every time they go back from, is that you, Drew? Did you watch it?
It's not me. Yeah, I've only done it once.
My name is Druella.
I would tell you.
I don't know. But that they're going to be able to go back. It's like a little present that keeps on giving. And every episode has like details that you didn't see the first time. So like, the more you watch it, the more you get from it.
My dream is, I saw Seven Samurai in Mexico City. My dad put it on for me. I watched this thing Japanese with Spanish subtitles. And afterwards, I declared to him, Dad, when I grow up, I want to be a samurai. So my dream is that a kid in Japan, 9 years old, watches this and then comes out and declares to his or her parents, when I grow up, I want to be an eagle warrior. And if that happens,
satisfied.
Done. You can, but done. You just kill me and I'll die with a smile.
Well, can you give us a little, like a hidden detail that people should be on the lookout for? Maybe in the first couple of episodes so we don't give anything away.
So there's a El Tigre Easter egg on the first episode. And then there's a big Book of Life Easter egg on episode 8.
Okay. Now I have to go back and rewatch them all.
There you
again.
Go, Drew.
How many skulls is too many skulls?
So the villain has 666. And I honestly think he could have used a little bit more. And there is not enough skulls in the world. It is an itch that will never be scratched.
What is it about skulls that is so appealing to you?
I don't know.
I'll tell you. So there's a saying I love, that every Mexican has death in their ear whispering live. So I like skulls everywhere, basically to remind everybody this is going to end, guys. You got to make it count.
What about aesthetics?
Right. Yeah, it's just something iconic about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a great line about, you know, life being short, and that's what makes it special. Yeah. And I feel like that is something that, yeah, yeah. Death and that
life
back. Go ahead. Yeah, the there you go.
Without death, there'd be no value to life.
Right. And I feel like we've all been living with that certainly over the past couple of years. And I feel like this is a great way to like process some of that. So you said that you wanted to make it even bigger. Can you give me some of these deleted episodes or ideas that just couldn't fit?
So
wow, that is a lot of head shaking.
So then,
the battle for starters.
Well, the battle, there were going to be, I mean, honestly, there were going to be just more gods. And more, there was going to be this crazy gauntlet, and then we were going to have gods from other cultures. So it was going to sort of imply that there's a whole network of gods and they all know each other. So like American gods. And then, at some point we had this ridiculous, like Mexico was a giant robot in itself. Like it was.
That's me saying no. I was like, no.
Yeah.
You stop there.
So that's what she was like, put the tequila down and let's make something that we can actually make.
Yeah, that's him getting a little too carried away. I just thank God, seriously, when he gave me the scripts to read, there were so many names in it and there were so many people and there were so many characters. I'm so happy that the characters are so identifiable in the series.
Yeah.
Because if it wasn't for the look of, and the visuals of them, I would not be able to identify them. Because they're
Yeah, there's a lot, but you do the kind of cold open that kind of establishes each culture. Yes. Was that always a part of it, or was that something that you found you needed as you were kind of going along?
I think you always wanted it.
Yeah, I love in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly how you get introduced to each of them.
Yeah.
So I was like, I'm going to do that with all the gods. I'm going to do that with all the worlds. Like, you know, it's part of the world building.
Plus, it helps. It helps.
Yeah. It almost reminded me, you know, I'm sure you've seen and loved the William Friedkin movie, Sorcerer.
Oh, yeah.
Each character has like 20 minutes of setup before they even get to the jungle. It was sort of like that.
I'm so happy that movie's been sort of rediscovered as a master.
Yeah, it's so great. Well, can you tease anything else that's coming down the pike that we should be on the lookout for? And where do we send our letters demanding Maya and the three action figures?
So we signed with Netflix for a while. So we're doing a movie, hopefully a series, maybe an adult thing. That's all we can say, but there's a lot of stuff coming.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for putting this out into the world. I absolutely adored it. And it's so great to talk to you face to face. Anytime you need to chat about something, please let me know. I'm always available. And Sandra, it was so nice to meet you.
Likewise. And you guys
enjoy the rest of your day and we'll talk soon, I'm sure.
You too, you have great energy.
Oh, thank you. Of course, talk to you soon, bye.
Take care, bye.
I have all of these questions because I really, really loved that show.
Well, listen, I'll reach out to Jorge today. He and I are kind of buddies and he will be on this promotional tour for a while, he says, for awards consideration and everything else. So we'll try to have him back and we'll see if Jim can redeem himself much in the same way that Maya redeems herself as the eagle warrior in Maya and the Three. But yes, I agree with everything that Jim said. It is appointment television's one of the most impressive animated feats of the year, I would say.
Absolutely. From the first episode where, you know, you establish the world. In fact, I mean, I love that there isn't a character in this that doesn't get a full arc. It is ridiculously confident storytelling.
Yes.
And let's also remind folks that this isn't the only ambitious animation that's coming from Netflix in the coming months. We have Summit of the Gods, which begins streaming on that service on November 30th. Likewise, we have Aardman's Sure to Be Charming holiday special, Robin Robin, which drops on Netflix on November 27th. Keep an ear out for future episodes of Fine Tuning, where we may bring on the filmmakers associated with Summit of the Gods and Robin Robin, and I will go out and get
Jim
myself
will show up. Yes,
well, that's right. I'm going to go out and get myself a watch. So I cannot believe I missed this interview. Anyway. If you're looking for a great podcast to listen to, to new episodes of Fine Tuning, perhaps I might even make an appearance on, show up. May I suggest Drew Taylor's terrific Light Diffuse. So what do you got on Light Diffuse this week?
Well, this week we're talking to Ben Rosenblatt, who's a really fascinating character, and he was an executive at Bad Robot and oversaw VFX for Rogue Nation, and he worked very closely with Tom on Ghost Protocol. So we get a lot of amazing stories, including who was almost hired to be the secretary in Ghost Protocol, and it's an even bigger star than Tom Wilkinson, so you definitely have to check that out. We were shocked. We were shocked to learn who they wanted, so yeah.
All right, folks, if you could do Drew and I have a favor. If you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well not just Fine Tuning, but also Light Diffuse, that would be incredibly helpful. Social media-wise, can you tell folks how to find you there, Drew?
Sure. It's Drew Taylor, like a tailored shirt, on Instagram and Twitter. And yeah, I put up some pictures from Oogie Boogie Bash, and have talked about Maya and all this other stuff on there. So please take a look.
As far as you can find us on Twitter and Instagram as Jim Hill Media, and on Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of Fine Tuning, folks. Thanks for listening, and take care.